Israeli military funder Chaim Sabin. The fellows there included the former head of Shin Bet, Avi Dichter, and the head of research for Israeli military intelligence, Yossi Kupferwasser. Eventually, following public outcry over Ken Roth, Harvard was seen to reverse its decision to cancel him. Doug Elmendorf writes, "In the case of Mr. Roth, I now believe that I made an error in my decision not to appoint him as a fellow at our Carr Center for Human Rights. I am sorry the decision inadvertently cast doubt on the mission of the school and our commitment to open debate in ways I had not intended and do not believe to be true. So all is well that ends well. Or is it? Ken Roth is far from the first person to be excluded from Harvard on this basis. In fact, U.S. academic Cornel West claims that he was refused tenure at Harvard in 2021 due to the heavily pro-Israel donors at the prestigious university. It is also reported that the biologist Robert Trivers was disinvited from giving a lecture at Harvard in 2007 following an intervention from a major donor to the university. This donor was none other than convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who is reported by close confidants to have gathered compromat for Israeli intelligence. Epstein, along with Israeli lobbyist Alan Dershowitz, opposed Trivers' visit due to his previous criticism of Israel. Freedom of speech, or even freedom of thought, seemed to be under threat at Harvard University.
As ever, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. He's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch, and he's recently been appointed as a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zaim University. Our guest expert today is Shahad Abu Salama. She is a Palestinian writer, activist and artist. Shahad was an associate lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University, but she was defamed and harassed by Zionist publications and was then suspended from her job. However, after a short but intense campaign, she was reinstated to her position. We spoke to Shahad earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, tell us about Human Rights Watch and Ken Roth.
So Human Rights Watch have famously joined a number of other human rights organisations, Amnesty, B'Tselem, etc., and described Israel as an apartheid state, you know, which it plainly is. And that has been the reason why he was initially denied his position at Harvard by the dean, Elmendorf. Mm. And then, of course, there was an outcry about it, and they were forced on the back foot to go back on it, and he's now been... this position has now been reinstated. So there's a kind of interesting tug of war going on here. So his criticisms of Israel are by no means radical criticisms. I mean, the idea that Israel is an apartheid state is not a radical idea anymore. It's something which is par for the course. Everybody knows this. But to say it in public discourse is the thing which is still a taboo. And so that's what he fell foul of. But the interesting thing is that they've been forced on the back foot over this. And the dean who took the decision has apologised for his decision-making.
Mm, interesting development there. But, I asked Shahad what the latest news was on her case at Sheffield Hallam University.
As for my developments my case at Sheffield Hallam University, I've been unfortunately stabbed in the back again by my now ex-employer, Sheffield Hallam. I officially ended my position on the 10th of October 2022. And that's after I was hounded by unjust investigations, one after the other, three in total, and I've been exonerated of all of them. But basically, I chose then to move on and look for an anti-racist, a genuinely anti-racist, anti-colonial organization where I feel I would thrive and not be subject to constant harassment and defamation. So that was unfortunately my wishful thinking, because nearly a month after this happened, I learned again from the Zionist press, namely the Jewish Chronicle, in a very shockingly, I mean, not shocking, to be honest, we're used to this level of harassment and smears and demonizations. But they basically went yet again attacking me and then framing me as a threat to the Jewish community, despite being yet again exonerated in an investigation that had just concluded, and the spokesperson, deputy chief of Sheffield Hallam, Mr. Calvert, had actually allowed the breach of some confidential information to the Jewish Chronicle.
David, I wonder whether you could say a word or two about Douglas Elmendorf and the significance of him being a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Well, Elmendorf has these various positions. He's the dean at Harvard. He's a senior fellow at Brookings, which is a think tank which is funded by, yes, the arms industry, but also by Zionist organisations. Actually, he's also a fellow at the Blavatnik Institute at the University of Oxford in the UK, in this country. So he has a number of different connections with what are effectively Zionist outfits. The Brookings has taken funds from the Zionists, has a centre set up by Chaim Saban, one of the key Zionist funders in the US, Blavatnik in this country, key Zionist funder. So he's well into that nexus. And of course, you wouldn't be surprised, given that he would have taken the decision that he did, which is all the more striking that he was forced to recant on his decision. And that's unusual. I mean, someone who had taken the decision as a kind of liberal would be more likely, you would think, to recant. But that must have been a lot of pressure for him to recant on that.
Mm. Well, I also asked Shahad why she thinks that Ken Roth was accused of being anti-Israel, while the rest of us, including her, were smeared by being accused of indulging in anti-Semitism.
It's, of course, it's ideological weaponization of terms. It's the same applies to Islam, you know. Someone's terrorist is another one's freedom fighter, and who's a freedom fighter in West media is mostly determined by the powerful, and those who are legitimately, for example, fighting against colonialism and apartheid are being demonized as terrorists because the occupier, the apartheid power, is an ally of these Western regimes.
David, what were the notorious Jeffrey Epstein's links with Israel, and how does that relate to Harvard?
Well, you saw in the film there, I mean, the well-known statement that he gathered compromat on behalf of Mossad. His co-conspirator, Robert Maxwell's daughter, Shalane, was also, it seems, involved in that. It seems like the whole Maxwell family were assets of Mossad, including her two brothers. I think she has one other sister. Mm. So it's an involvement there. And it seems to have been that the whole operation was allowed to proceed effectively by Mossad in order that they could gain the compromise. But Epstein himself had donated over $700,000, I think it was, between being arrested and convicted to Harvard as part of his strategy to launder his image, I guess. And he had been involved also in trying to stop certain people speaking at Harvard. So that's the really interesting little snippet here, is that he was not only was being used as an asset by Mossad, but actually also trying to promote Israel's interests by censoring people in terms of public discourse. And he was very closely connected in that sense by a guy called Wexner, who we might come on to in a minute, who ran Victoria's Secret, a huge Zionist donor, including to Harvard as well.
Mm. Well, I then asked Shahad how things in the UK compare to the US and whether it's actually worse there than it is here.
It's not better or worse. It's very similar. And we are seeing a pattern, you know, between all these settler colonial states. Actually, it's not shocking to see the US, for example, consistently silencing Palestinian voices and pro-Palestine voices.
Well, we've now got another report now on Zionist donors to Harvard University and the role that they may have played in the cancellation of pro-Palestinian voices.
Following our examination of some of the academics and public figures cancelled by Harvard University for their pro-Palestinian positions, it is important we delve into the considerable Zionist connections of key donors and high-ranking figures within the university. The first donor worthy of examination is Thomas S. Kaplan, the well-known entrepreneur and member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has been instrumental in a foundation named after his late mother, the Lillian Jean Kaplan Foundation, which has funded the settler organization, the Temple Institute, which is working to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque and replace it with a Jewish temple. Kaplan was also on the board of the 92nd Street Y Cultural Center in New York, which canceled a talk by Dr. Izzeldin Aboulesh, who lost three family members to the Israeli military. Thomas Kaplan also funds the Rekanati Kaplan Intelligence Fellows, which trains figures from U.S. and Israeli intelligence. Another key donor who might have asserted influence over these cancellations is the billionaire Leslie Wexner. He funds the Wexner Israel Fellowship at the university as part of the Center for Public Leadership. The fellowship aims to provide Israel's next generation of public leaders with superlative training in public management and leadership development. Graduates of the program include Shin Bet Chief Ami Ayalon and four major generals, Yedidi Yayari, Shay Avital, Amos Yadlin, and Yohanan Locker, later Netanyahu's military secretary. In 2016, the Israeli regime listed the Wexner Foundation on a list of public sector reserve programs organized directly by the Israeli Prime Minister's office. The next figure at the Harvard Kennedy School with significant links to Israel is Eden Offer, who sits on the Dean's Executive Board alongside his wife. Shipping billionaire Eden Offer's companies are reported as being used by Israeli intelligence to transport agents through the Middle East in key assassinations. It is believed the Offer family ships were used to transport agents who killed Mahmoud al-Manhu, chief of logistics and weapons procurement for the military wing of Palestinian resistance group Hamas. Another key funder is Robert Belfer, who sits on the board of governors at Israeli lobby group, the American Jewish Committee. He also works closely with Israeli lobby group, the Anti-Defamation League. Another example of the pro-Israel bias that exists at Harvard Kennedy School is the addition of former Israeli military general Amos Yadlin, who also sits as the executive director of the Israeli intelligence think tank, the Institute for National Security Studies, as a Harvard senior fellow lecturing students. There is clearly a high level of influence from Zionist lobbyists in key positions of Harvard University.
David, tell us a bit more about the Temple Institute and Thomas Kaplan, who's a key funder of Harvard, isn't he?
Yeah, so the Temple Institute, which we've covered in this show before, is an organization based in occupied Al-Quds in Jerusalem, which is dedicated to the demolition, you heard that correctly, the demolition of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the replacement of it by a Jewish temple as part of their notion that this will bring the Day of Reckoning a little bit closer. So it's an extreme settler organization, and it's supported by this guy Kaplan, who's a billionaire, one of the key funders of Harvard. And you can see the connections here. This is a connection we've found time and time again on this show. People who are funding pro-Israel stuff in the US or the UK or other Western European countries are also engaged directly in funding illegal settlement activity, which is directly involved and implicated in the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
Mm. Well, Shahad then told us what she made of Amos Yadlin, the former head of Israeli military intelligence, being able to lecture at Harvard University.
This is literally another example of how we see, as Palestinians, our oppression being normalized on all platforms, similar to this warmonger or even war criminal. And we see people like him always using places, our universities, the media, platforms like this in order to legitimate their crimes against the Palestinians.
David, I mean, you mentioned earlier in the one of your previous answers about Leslie Wexner. I mean, he not only seems to be key to Israeli government operations, but he was also linked to Epstein's role in the university, wasn't he?
Yeah, him and Epstein were mates, and they were involved in donating together. You can see there, one of the buildings. There are buildings named after all sorts of different Zionist donors, yes, in Harvard, just as there are in Oxford and Cambridge.
Sure.
Extraordinary, when you start to add them all up, the amount of them. And the Wexner, of course, is Victoria's Secret, and you know, there's an industry which is not unadjacent to the stuff which Epstein was supposed to be getting up to with his Lolita Express and his private island, and the trafficking of young girls and women to be sexually exploited for the production of compromise. So there's a clear set of a nexus here, and an attempt to, in a way, to give a positive public image to that nexus by donation to one of the most prestigious universities, the most prestigious university in the US, which, of course, is Harvard. So that's what's going on here.
I wonder whether you could say also a word or two about Idan Ofer. There seems to be quite a sinister element to that story. I mean, the guy's also active in London, isn't he?
So the Ofer family is the big shipping family, and as we heard in the film there, they were involved. It's been publicly noted now that they've been involved in allowing their ships to be used by Mossad for ops, including operations in Iran. So they were traveling to Iran, and there was stories about this. They're breaking the boycott of Iran. Mm. Well, actually, they were doing it at the behest of Mossad, so they could transport their operatives to undertake assassinations and murders in Iran. I mean, that's the direct role there. But in terms of the Harvard connection, yes, there's a connection at Harvard, and there's the programs named after Ofer, just as there are in other places. For example, in the interdisciplinary center in Herzliya in occupied Palestine, which is the only private university there, and which reserves 20% of those places for elite military or intelligence personnel, there's an Ofer center there, Sami Ofer Center, named after Iden's dad, Sami Ofer. In London, there's a Sami Ofer building just near Regent's Park, which is part of the London Business School. So that the money is sprayed around all over the place as a means to launder the image of these people who are engaged effectively in terrorism.
Mm. Well, Shehad also gave us her thoughts on how she thinks the story is going to develop and whether we're likely to see more victories on the horizon.
The tide is changing. And I think Israel is probably helping us by electing even more and more extremist governments, although all governments systematically and firmly, left and right, have been unified when it comes to the domination and the occupation of the Palestinians. But what is happening recently in Palestine is definitely worrying. We count on the sumud of the Palestinian people and their continued existence and resistance in the face of the illegal occupier. And we count on all those people of conscience that are rising and seeing all these paradoxes that are around us.
And finally, David, I wonder whether you could tell us about this other funder, Robert Balfour.
Yes, there's a Belfer Center at Harvard, which is kind of a think tank based at Harvard. And Belfer, again, a key Zionist its funder. So you see a picture here of a really rather large number of very significant Zionist funders. We haven't listed all of them in this show, but the ones we've listed are already enough to show a very significant influence of Zionist money in the university in general and in the social sciences and social and political sciences in general. And, of course, if that means that someone at Harvard happens to produce some decent research, I'm sure the decent research could be published, unless, of course, it is in any way critical of Zionism or the Zionist entity. And that's how this works. You know, it's not even that people are necessarily totally censored, which, of course, does happen, but that if they did come up with anything decent, any decent piece of work which is critical of Israel, it would be stopped.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time again today. Thanks to our guests, Shahad Abu Salama, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. The revelations in today's programme are ignored by the corporate media, so please share the information we've provided today to help expose these nefarious practices. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. Allah tells the people that He is the sole administrator of the affairs of the world, and if we have trust in Him, we will be given any type of facilities we need. This means to accept all of Allah's plans in all aspects of our lives. Based upon the Holy Quran, Allah will pour on believers His blessings from the heavens and the earth.
خدا میگه ولکن کذبوا مردم منو تکذیب میکنن قبول ندارن.
Of course, in Surah Al-Araf, Ayah 96, we read, if the people of the towns had been faithful and God-wary, we would have opened to them blessings from the heaven and the earth. But they denied. So we seized them because of what they used to earn. This ayah means that if we practice according to the plans of other than Allah, we'll be trapped in a vicious circle. Our anxieties, suspicion, enmity, and hatred will be more if we lose hope in Allah and we rely on others instead of Him. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
History of knowledge in Iran. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program. The year 2022 was dubbed by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, as the International Year of Basic Sciences for Sustainable Development, IYBSSD 2022, to mark the importance and role of knowledge. As per the UNESCO motto of the year 2022, more serious attention has been paid to sciences like physics, chemistry, math, geology, biology, statistics, and genetics. Planning and execution of events related to basic sciences, promotion of programs to familiarize various nations with their notables in basic sciences, and acquaintance with the global capacities of this domain were among the programs of last year. In this new series, we are going to make you familiar with the past record of basic sciences in Iran and the innumerable services that Iranians have rendered to mankind through centuries. Basic sciences play an important role in execution of developmental programs. For instance, they provide us with necessary tools to face vital challenges, such as global access to food, energy, hygiene, and communication technologies. Basic sciences are the fundamentals of technological progresses. Moreover, training of specialists and development of life conditions require the growth and development of basic sciences. History of production of sciences in Iran dates back to very old times. Knowledge was venerated and respected so much so that poets would versify poems on the issue. The globally renowned poet Abolghasem Ferdowsi was one of such poets. Among other poets who have glorified knowledge, mention can be made of Rudaki, Samarqandi, Nasir Khosro, Sa'di, and so on. Nasir Khosro says in a poem that if you achieve knowledge, you will dominate over the sky. Islam has put a special emphasis on acquisition of sciences, and different sciences are highly recommended, particularly those which are more useful for mankind. In view of this, scholars, scientists, and researchers are highly respected. Although Iran, due to its unique geopolitical situation, diverse climates, and endless resources, has been subjected to cruel assaults of different invaders, it has attracted the beauties of invading cultures and highly impacted them. Therefore, today, one can find countless customs, vocabulary, and inventions among many nations which have their roots in Iran's rich culture. Iran used to be known as the cradle of sciences. For example, Muhammad ibn Zakaria Khwarizmi devised algorithm which revolutionized the science of algebra. Hence, he founded the basis for Indian and Iranian arithmetic system. This caused Europeans to change their numerical system from Latin into Indian. Al-Khwarizmi's inventions had a fundamental impact on advancement of math in Western countries. Medicine has had a bright record in Iran, and many books have been written in this field. Iran has played a significant role in expansion of sciences in ancient Greece and has also been influential in the Indian medicine. Jondi Shapur University in Ahvaz was a noted academic center in old Iran, and many students would come to it to study sciences, particularly medical sciences, as there was a hospital adjacent to the university which has been claimed to be the first hospital in the modern meaning of the word. This hospital enjoyed separate wards for different patients and various medical services. Mohammad Zakaria Razi, the renowned Iranian physician, chemist, and philosopher, was the first person to use experimental medicines to cure diseases. He discovered alcohol, sulfuric acid, chloric acid, and citric acid. He attained many achievements in medicine, so that George Sartain has called him the greatest physician of Islam and Middle Ages. Apparently, Ibn Sina, or Avicenna, authored his Al-Qanun book through inspiration of Razi's Al-Hawi. Nearly 1,000 years ago, Abu Reyhan Biruni, another globally noted Iranian genius, wrote an encyclopedia on astronomy wherein he has discussed the rotation of the Earth around the Sun. A long time before the Danish Tycho Brahe, he drew the first map of the sky using the pictures and figures of animals to describe heavenly constellations and bodies. In 10th century AD, the prominent Iranian astronomer and mathematician Abdurrahman Sufi studied the stars and for the first time registered the galaxy without the help of a telescope. He discovered the nebula Chained Woman on and Andromeda galaxy. Thus, he corrected the views of Ptolemy. Jaber ibn Hayyan was an Iranian chemist and philosopher who is known as the father of chemistry. His discoveries have been gathered in an encyclopedia. This genius devised many methods and invented many tools which are used to date by chemists. Ibn Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in the West, was another great Iranian scientist who is famous for his writings on optics and experiments on lens, mirror, and light. He's known as the father of light physics. To name a few other Iranian scientists, mention can be made of the astronomer and mathematician Abu Abbas Fazl Hatam Nehrizi, Banu Musa brothers, who were specialists in math, astronomy, and mechanics. We can also name Abu Zayd Ahmad ibn Balkhi, geographer and mathematician, Abu al-Wafa Buzjani, mathematician and astronomer, Qiyasuddin Jamshid Kashani, mathematician and astronomer, and Omar Khayyam, astronomer, mathematician and poet. Well, on that note, we have come to the end of this episode. We hope that you have enjoyed this program. Till next episode, goodbye.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddimat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad Hussain. This program and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the rules of purification or tahara based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javed, let me ask you this question. This question, you know, might be pertinent to, you know, villages, for example, or those people who have orchards and farms. And they may use some of the spring water, you know, which are applicable to those situations and scenarios. And if one farmer, for example, wants to use the water of the spring, sometimes they have to, you know, plant some pipes.
Yes.
From the spring, you know, source all the way to their own farms.
Yeah.
All right. And sometimes they need to put or plant the pipes inside other people's farms.
Yeah.
Right. Or land, pieces of land. So in case of dissent or dissatisfaction on the part of the other farmers, for example, or the owners of those pieces of land where you have to place the pipes in, is it still permissible to use the spring water for wudu, ghusl, or any other acts, religious acts, or purification?
Well, if the spring is natural, situated beside or outside other people's property,
mm-hmm.
and its water flows into the pipes before it flows on others' property, you see, and of course carried to those areas which you mentioned, there's no objection, or there's nothing wrong with using the water, because you're not actually trespassing, and you're not using another person's property, or you're not crossing the boundaries and usurping another person's property. But of course, if In common view, it is considered to be a violation of others' properties, then it's not permissible to make wudu or to use the water. Using the spring water in and of itself is permissible because it's natural water coming out from the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not permissible to walk on another person's property or to violate others' properties because that makes your wudu problematic. And in order not to face this problem, you should make sure whether it is considered in common view, whether it is considered violation or not. If it's not, then there's no problem. And if it is in common view considered to be violation of other people's property, then the your wudu is going to be problematic.
Mm-hmm. I see. Before getting to my other or next questions, let's take a short break and we'll be back and become back with lots of other more questions regarding the rules of purification based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on Arabi English Radio. We are still with Sheikh Javid helping me, with some of the questions and answers related to the rules of purification based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, I'm going to ask you a series of questions based on this premise that I give you first. Although the city water supply department interdicted installation of pumps, water pumps in the pipeline,
yeah,
or along the pipeline. In some places, water pressure is so low, especially when it comes to apartments, for example, very tall apartments. In higher stories, they are kind of forced to use water pumps. So considering this scenario, would you please answer these questions? According to Islam, Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to install water pumps in order to use more water, or in places where, like the high stories, for example, where the pressure of the water is so low?
Well, Ayatollah Khamenei's answer to this question is short, but it is clear. Mm-hmm. and it's explicit.
Right.
His Eminence says that in this scenario, of course, it's not permissible to install and use a pump.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he also says that actually using a pump means gaining or receiving more water than other people. And there are people who do not use pumps and they are deprived of the water in cities where the water pressure is so low. So basically using a water pump is not permissible according to His Eminence.
Okay. The other question that I would like to ask you is that if it is not permissible, as you said, what is the ruling in relation to performing wudu and ghusl with the water obtained through such a water pump?
And again, the answer is very clear. His Eminence says that performing wudu and ghusl with the water obtained through a pump is problematic. it is a matter of objection. He doesn't explicitly say that, okay, it's invalid, but it's a matter of ishkal, which means there is problem in it, and one should avoid this, problem, and not use the water which is obtained through the pump. Yes.
I see. Shift a bit, in one of your answers, to the best of my recall, you have stated that if wudu is done at a time near to the beginning time of prayer, the prayer performed therein is valid. So how far before the beginning time of prayer have you meant?
Well, I think we discussed it in one of the episodes, and it said that, wudu can be performed at any time because it is recommended to be in the state of ritual impurity, and whenever a person's wudu is made void, he can repeat it, he can make wudu again, and as long as the wudu is mustahab, then of course it's always permissible to perform any prayers with a mustahab wudu. And but when it comes to a wudu performed for a particular wajib prayer, like for example Maghrib prayer, it is to be performed any time before the wajib prayer. But there shouldn't be a big gap between the wudu and the time for the obligatory prayer, because otherwise the intention made for that wudu would be problematic. Because for example, if you have got 2 hours and you make wudu for the same for the wajib prayer, like Maghrib prayer, so that wudu, because the time of the prayer has not set in yet, and the wudu that you are going to make is not wajib. Because when the time of the prayer sets in, it's then obligatory to take action to perform wudu. But when the time is not has set in, it's not necessary. And the wudu that you are making with that intention does not make sense. It's not wajib. It's not mustahab either. So to make wudu for that prayer. So it's necessary to make wudu as close to the time of the wajib prayer as possible. Otherwise, it will be problematic. Yes, if you want to make a mustahab wudu, there is no objection. It's permissible to make a mustahab wudu at any time one wishes to.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers to these questions related to the rules of purification based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.